Robots Radio. Games. Lore. Stories. Community. Just press play. Welcome to the Fallout Lorecast, the podcast that explores the boundaries of our knowledge about the world of Fallout. So here's a question for you. What happens when you combine Darth Vader from Star Wars, of course, the Mountain from Game of Thrones, and Clint Eastwood? Oh, I couldn't say that with a straight face. Clint Eastwood from a 1993 movie in The Line of Fire. That's right. You probably guessed it. You get Frank Horrigan from Fallout 2. I was going to be so serious on the intro on this, but I think I'm going to keep me cracking up, because that's just hilarious. Frank Horrigan, you might be wondering, so let me back up a little bit before we get into this episode. There are some of you on the Discord who have been asking for a Frank Horrigan episode, because I haven't done Frank Horrigan yet. He is the final boss of Fallout 2, and is very much a final boss and very much a character you would design in the 90s. And we're going to go into everything that I could find out today about Frank Horrigan and exactly who he is and how he became this behemoth of a super mutant power armored freakazoid thing that you have to deal with in Fallout 2. But also how some of the aspects of his character are clearly linked, or at least can be seen in other similar types of characters, like Darth Vader, or the Mountain, or Clint Eastwood. So that's today's episode. I hope you enjoy it. Let's get into it. Okay, so I have to address the whole Clint Eastwood thing here. He played a character in the movie In the Line of Fire from 1993 named Frank Horrigan. And he was, in that movie, a Secret Service agent who was protecting the president. And so this does play into it. This isn't just a joke. And no, Frank Horrigan and Clint Eastwood don't look similar or anything like that. The connection here is that both Frank Horrigans play specific kinds of individuals who worked for a president and whose job it was to do the things that the president would want and also to keep that president safe. So that's the connection. And I'm just going to put this here in the beginning of the episode in order to clarify that that was not a joke. This is an actual reference. Also, Darth Vader is going to make a lot of sense as we get through this. And the Mountain, if you watched the Game of Thrones show or if you've read the Song of Ice and Fire books, that's going to make sense as well. But here, let's get into what we do know about Frank Horrigan. Frank was born in 2211. And remember, this is Fallout 2. Frank only shows up in Fallout 2 and is referenced a lot in the Fallout Bible. And a reminder for those of you who skipped over that episode or just don't know much about the Fallout Bible. The Fallout Bible was a series of answers to questions that people had in the late 90s, early 2000s, when people had played through Fallout 1 and Fallout 2 and were discussing on the early internet what was actually going on. And they wanted to dive a little bit deeper into this really interesting world. And so the Fallout Bible was basically answers to questions by Chris Avalone that people were asking at the time. And some of those things are canon and some of them are still speculation. So we have to treat anything that is answered with a Fallout Bible answer as a potential answer. And that might actually be the way things are, or at least that was the way things were 20 some years ago when the developers were working on those first two Fallout games. Now, whether those things are canonized or not later on, that's another debate. And honestly, I'm a little tired personally of the whole everybody focusing so much on what is canon and what isn't. Ultimately, it really doesn't matter that much. It really comes down to these are the things that we know. These are the things that were in the minds of the developers. And that's interesting enough on its own. I think that's good. So here, let's dig into Frank Horrigan, born 2211, and from the beginning was described in Fallout 2 as a huge brick of a man. He was a brick house. He was a big guy. He was a personal bodyguard for President Dick Richardson. And yes, if you haven't played Fallout 2 or you skipped over those episodes, that was the president's name. He was the man with the same name twice. Dick Richardson, because Dick also could mean Richard. And from the beginning, he was always considered to be a little bit out there. There was what is described as an undocumented psychotic blunder that he made that caused him to be reassigned to Wasteland Patrol duty. He was always a little bit out there. And while he was out on Wasteland duty, he was on an expedition and he came into contact with the FEV, the Forced Evolutionary Virus, at the Mariposa military base. This is where they were testing the virus. This is the very location where Maxon rebelled against the directions that he had from the military and decided that what they were doing there was not right and stood against them. Well, at that same location, he came across the FEV. And we don't know the specific details of how this happened, but it was enough of an exposure that he started mutating into a super mutant. And the Enclave, who he was working for at the time, they'd been very clearly established by the 2200s, send him for testing to the oil rig. And this is another location that you need to be aware of. If you haven't played Fallout 2, the oil rig is the location that the Enclave were in. It's a place that many of them went to when the bombs dropped in order to stay safe during the Great War. It's a place that was still in operation 100 and something years later and was, at least for this group of the Enclave, their base, the one place that we know where they were located. And clearly, as the stories have gone on, we've learned that the Enclave had many other locations that they were operating out of, and probably more than we know of right now, especially with the information that we've seen from the Fallout TV show. But during Fallout 2, this was the location for the Enclave. It's all we knew about. It was not only the place where their leaders operated out of, but it was also a place where they were doing testing. They were continuing to test individuals with the FEV virus. Just because Mariposa was shut down does not mean that the Enclave gave up on their testing and on their plans to create a super soldier and to use that super soldier, at least now, post-war, in the Wasteland in order to do what they needed to do. There's evidence of this in the Fallout TV show when we see Wilzig leaving the Enclave research location. They cart out a super mutant, and we can see its hand underneath the fabric on the gurney. They are still testing, in the latest part of the timeline, super mutants and trying to make super soldiers. Now, Frank was a very specific case with this, though. He wasn't just your average super mutant. He was somebody who they continued to test on. He was somebody who was already psychologically out there, but also somebody who went through more FEV trials and tests at the oil rig than anybody else had ever gone through at this point. And although he was already a brick of a man, somebody who was very large, very built, imagine taking that kind of person and turning them into a super mutant. It just accentuated his natural fitness and strength and size. He became ridiculous, like just absolutely ridiculously huge and also mentally disturbed. And you know, I should have included Adam Smasher from Cyberpunk in this list of villains that, or at least characters that he is very similar to, because not only did he become gigantic and a large super mutant, but he also was augmented with technology. The character Granite in Fallout 2 describes him like this. He's some genetically engineered freak is what he is. Used to be the president's bodyguard, Secret Service agent Frank Horrigan. Now he's more than half machine. So there's a clear similarity to both Darth Vader and Atom Smasher. More machine than man at this point. So by 2239, and we don't have the exact date that he started turning into a super mutant, but we know that he was about 28 years old at this point. The Enclave had decided that their testing had kind of reached an end. They had done as much as they possibly could with him by that point. He was very much a super mutant and also mostly machine, and his mind had been altered. Like every super mutant, he became less intelligent, more easy to manipulate by the Enclave themselves, because they needed somebody who would be absolutely 100% loyal to them and the mission. You wouldn't want somebody like Frank Horrigan running around and being a loose cannon. But that's kind of what he became, because they decided to start sending him back out into the wasteland in order to fulfill their missions. He would take on missions where he would end up having to approach settlers or individuals in order to gain things for the Enclave. And every time he came up across somebody who was willing to stand up to him, it was generally believed that they wouldn't last more than 60 seconds. And this comes from other dialogue in the game. This idea that nobody could stand up against him. And this is a very The Mountain in Game of Thrones kind of thing. He's a big guy. He's ready to be violent at a moment's notice. And nobody can stand their ground against him, because he will just destroy them. Oh, and did I mention he wasn't just a super mutant with a bunch of mechanical augmentation? He also had a very special suit of power armor. So he was a cybernetically augmented super mutant in power armor. And it wasn't just any power armor. This wasn't like they were like, oh, we're going to throw him in a T-51 and make it a little bit bigger. No, this was a specially designed Enclave suit of armor based off of all the technology that they had developed to this point, 100 and something years after the bombs dropped, and they put him in that. And clearly that was for reasons of combat effectiveness and keeping him safe, but it also did something else as well. Much like Darth Vader, he couldn't survive outside of his suit, because it was constantly injecting him with drugs and chemicals in order to keep him alive. In some ways, as I think through all of this, he really does feel like the kind of super bad guy that you would design if you worked for a video game studio in the late 90s. Let's just draw from all of these other inspirations. He's a super mutant. He's super strong. He's really fast. He's in a really cool set of armor that does really cool stuff. It's powered by fusion cells on his back, which was added in the Modiphius tabletop version of the game. He's cybernetically augmented, and he's unstable mentally. He's ready to snap at any moment and kill anybody who gets in his way. He's 100% focused on doing his mission and working for the bad guys, the Enclave, in whatever capacity they want him to do things in. It sounds like a late 90s villain. It sounds like something you would see in a comic book. And that's part of what makes him so fun, is that he's just a really big, pissed off, bad guy. He's like a force of nature, and you don't want to get in his way. But there was one other individual in the wasteland who proved to be a bigger badass than Frank Horrigan. They were known as the Chosen One. And this is where you come into the story. But we'll get to that after we thank our patrons, so don't go anywhere. I'll be right back.
Don't you deserve a Medicare plan you can count on? Well, you can count on a Medicare Advantage plan from UnitedHealthcare. Enjoy reliable coverage and low out-of-pocket costs with a Medicare Advantage plan from UnitedHealthcare. And if you have a chronic condition like diabetes, chronic heart failure, or a cardiovascular disorder, you may qualify for a UnitedHealthcare Complete Care plan with plans that fit your life today and as your needs change tomorrow. Find out more about UnitedHealthcare plans at uhc.com/Medicare.
Hello there, old chap. Good to see another of General Atomic's finest, still eager to serve.
All right, welcome to the middle of the show. This is where we get to thank our patrons for being so awesome. And welcome our newest patrons, Allie B., Ryan G., Souped Up Sammy. I knew I was going to mess that up. Thanks, Sammy. And Jose F. Welcome to the Patreon. I'm so glad that you're here. I hope you're enjoying the ad-free episodes and the other perks that you can get, like stickers and t-shirts and joining us on the Patreon chat, which is coming up in a few weeks. We're already a little bit of the way into June. And just a reminder, we usually do the Patreon chats on the last Wednesday night, 9 p.m. Eastern, of the month. So that would be the 26th of this month. So just a few weeks away. If you'd like to join us for that, there's still time to sign up. Also, I have to shout out our Sentry bots, Germinator and Pluto Mayhem. Thank you so much for supporting at that level. And to all 117 of our current active patrons, thank you so very much. I couldn't do the show without you. Also, let's read some other reviews that have come in over the last few months. I've had so many of them, I've been trying to space them out. This one comes from Better Meta Goat in the United States. He writes, keeps me coming back for more lore. Robots is an excellent host who does amazing deep dives into not only the lore, but also the psychology behind the themes portrayed in the Fallout franchise, games, and show. I grew up playing Fallout 3 and later New Vegas and Fallout 4. And when the Amazon show was released, I couldn't stop watching, which led me to seek out a podcast about Fallout. I enjoy listening to the show at work, and it makes my otherwise repetitive day go by with a bit of pizzazz. If you're looking for an excellent show about the lore of Fallout, this is the place to be. Thanks so much, Better Goat. And then this one from Wow Vagrimt from Sweden. I don't know what that means, but it probably means something. Short and sweet. Great. I can't recommend it more. Thank you so much, Wow. And then this one from JJ2609 in Australia. Awesome lore. Awesome podcast. Am currently binging all episodes from start, so I'm going to use the opportunity to tell my future self once I catch up is count to four, inhale, count to four, exhale. A reminder that everything will be okay. Thank you, robots with zeros. Totally how I say it, right? Der. From now on, I'll call you nobody because, like the podcast, nobody is perfect. Thank you, JJ. And yes, breathe. Everything will be fine. Thank you so much to those of you who take time to leave reviews and to share it with your friends and to rate the show on Spotify. If you listen on Spotify, 5 stars on there would be amazing. All of that stuff is super helpful. So thanks for being here. All right, let's continue with our story about Frank Horrigan.
If you have any questions about Nuka World, I'd be delighted to answer them.
So let's talk about how you get involved here. There's a situation that happens exactly on August 30th, 2241 in Fallout 2. And remember, Fallout 1 and Fallout 2 had very specific timelines and events that happened on certain dates, time limits for how the games would play out. You needed to be able to do a certain thing by a certain time and in order for the game to actually work out. You were kind of gated in that way, in a way that modern games don't do. So in the game, there is a scripted event on August 30th, 2241, where Frank Horrigan is tasked with hunting down and recruiting an elderly farmer with some knowledge that could prove dangerous to the Enclave. In this situation, Frank was simply a weapon. He was to show up, find the farmer, kill him without a second thought, and leave. And he did. And at that moment in the game, you're there. You're the chosen one. And you witness this execution in front of you. And Frank makes the biggest mistake of his life. And that's saying a lot. He's done a lot of terrible things and definitely ended up in a situation with the Enclave that he probably wasn't planning on happening. I mean, who plans on being a super mutant and one of the biggest killing weapons of the bad guys in Fallout 2? not too many people choose that as a future career. So he was in this situation, and instead of killing the Chosen One, he leaves him, and he walks away. Now, why he would choose to do that, I don't know that there's an answer to that. I mean, I think the meta answer is, well, it plays into the storyline. You meet this terrible behemoth of a monster super mutant person, and you realize how terrible they are, and it's a Chekhov's gun kind of situation. You could see exactly how terrifying and how powerful and how, I guess, without any remorse, this creature, I mean, it's a creature at this point, this Frank creature, Frankenstein, is that, oh my God, that's another similarity. I hadn't just thought about that. But you find out exactly how terrible this person is. And this is a storytelling trope that we see all the time. You hint at the big bad, you hint at the terrible situation or the absolutely worst person that you're going to have to deal with in the game later on. Adam Smasher, they do this in Cyberpunk 2077, even though that came out, you know, 20 some years later. They do this in movies all the time, where you are proven time and time again throughout the story as the climax gets closer and closer, how dangerous and terrible the bad guys actually are. And then you have to confront them directly. It's a wonderful storytelling trope because it tells you what the odds are. It tells you that this thing or this person that you're going to have to deal with is difficult. This is not going to be easy. And in many of these situations, and this happens again in video games, in movies, in comic books, oftentimes the bad guy, the Thanos of the story, is so much more powerful than any of the heroes. The heroes have to do something different in order to deal with them. They have to outsmart them. They have to come across some super weapon. They have to do something because there's no chance in the early moment of the story that the hero would be able to defeat that villain. They're just too powerful. And that's exactly what happens at the end of Fallout 2. Spoilers, by the way. You invade, you as the Chosen One, invade the control station enclave. You go to the oil rig. You trigger a meltdown. And guess who's there to protect the oil rig? Frank Horrigan. And Frank personally secures the exit to prevent you from leaving. You are cornered. You have to go through Frank in order to make it out. And so you fight him. And depending on how you build your character in the game and what weapons you have and all of that, you find a way to do enough damage in order to take him out. And the sequence is pretty cool. He's bisected at the waist. You chop him in half. He's mortally wounded. But he doesn't instantly die. Remember, he's hopped up on all sorts of crazy drugs and he's half machine anyway. And he gets up on his hands and he taunts you one more time and lets you know that he activated the self-destruct program. You may have accomplished the impossible. You may have taken down the Enclave's base and beat the biggest badass in the wasteland in a fight one-on-one, but he's not going to let you get out alive. He says that you would die in a big old mushroom cloud send-off. And then after that, and you can see this in the animations in the game, he crawls, his top half of his torso crawls forward a few more steps, and then his head blows off. Presumably from the internal pressure building in his suit and the malfunctioning that's going on inside his own body. So after this moment, you have now killed the president, Dick Richardson. Such a funny name to me. Frank Horrigan, you've saved other people, the captured Vault 13 dwellers, and you make it off the oil rig before everything explodes. But what I wish we knew more about is who Frank really was. we don't get much of his backstory. We don't know why, from the beginning, he was so adamant in focusing on protecting the president and believing the Enclave. We don't have a backstory for that. And it's unfortunate because, yeah, he's kind of a comic booky villain. And the end of the game plays out like a 1990s action movie, which is fun. There's nothing wrong with that. It's a little bit of a trope at this point, but it's still fun. But who was he deep down originally? Where did he really come from? We don't really know. We do know a little bit more about his video game stats. For example, he has 999 HP. This is seemingly the highest number that the game goes up to because it doesn't go up to 1,000. This is pretty similar to like in the Final Fantasy games where you max out your character level or fight against a big enemy and they're at like 99999 health or whatever. It's kind of like that. He also has a unique set of power armor, which has been modeled in other locations. There's a skin version in Fallout 76 that you can get if you want. He also has two weapons that you cannot get anywhere else in the game. He has a very specific plasma gun called the End Boss Plasma Gun. And yeah, that's the name. It's called End Boss Plasma Gun. It's a very specifically designed weapon for him by the Enclave. And also a knife, which is called the End Boss Knife. This is real. This is what they really are called. And typically he will try to shoot you until he runs out of ammo and then he'll try to use the knife. And remember, in Fallout 2, everything was still kind of turn-based. So he would have a large amount of AP. And so he was able to move around quickly and take on multiple actions at a time. And in Fallout 2, way back in Fallout 2, you could disable somebody's arms or legs or whatever with enough damage. So if you were able to somehow disable his use of using those weapons, he would still fight you physically. And that would come from, you know, multiple shots to the head. So his vision was bad, so he couldn't shoot anymore. Or you would disable the arm with the knife, and so he would punch you instead. You know, typical Fallout stuff. He would still do that. And his power armor was a little bit better than the advanced power armor that the regular Enclave soldiers would use, and was mostly resistant, like very highly resistant to small arms fire, lasers, plasma, explosions. The one thing that it is slightly more vulnerable to is electricity. And even critical hits were not an effective way of bypassing these resistances. He was very much designed to be a very difficult endgame boss in the style of 1990s games, where you have to 100% make sure that you are leveled up well enough, that you are equipped, and that you understand the game's mechanics in order to take on an enemy like this. Because if you aren't, you hit a hard wall. That was how difficult these games were back then. So it's no wonder that Frank Horrigan holds a special place in Fallout fans' hearts, especially those players who played through Fallout 1 or Fallout 2 way back when they first came out. Because he was a character that was not easy to forget. He was absolutely imposing. He was more difficult than anything else you'd come across, including Deathclaws. And he was a very difficult final boss. And as the Dark Souls games have proven, when you pit players against an enemy like this that kicks your butt over and over again, and then you finally figure out how to beat the game, it stays with you. You feel like you've actually accomplished something because you had to work for it. It wasn't just, I played the game until I was done playing the game. There's a reason why in early video games, people would say, did you beat the game? Because you legitimately had to beat some sort of difficult thing. It wasn't, did you just finish the game, like you finish reading a book? It was, did you beat the game? Because Frank Horrigan was a monster. And he has a special place in Fallout fans' hearts. I would love to see another character, similar, not exactly the same, but another highly powerful super mutant, specialized by the Enclave in warfare. What if in either the Fallout TV show in future seasons, or in Fallout 5, or whatever Fallout we get next, we get actual super soldiers? What if the Enclave has survived, which I'm pretty sure they have, and they are off somewhere doing experiments, and after 200 plus years, have started to really dial in the super soldier program? What if in the next Fallout, we have to fight an army of Frank Horrigans? What do we do then? To plug into everything else we're doing, check out robotsradio.net. Reach out to me on Twitter at robots_radio. Check out the Robots Radio Rocket Club, where you can join me and a bunch of our other creators creating your podcast, starting a new podcast, or helping your current podcast grow. There's more information about that on robotsradio.net as well. And you can always talk with us and the entire community, over 2,000 people on the Robots Radio Discord. Come join us. We'd love to chat with you. See you guys next time.